Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. I'm
From the
Alex. Yeah,
top.
we're doing it from the top. I'm Alex. With me, as usual, is James. Check out our website, themacguffinmen.com. Got a lot of good content. We talked about Vertigo, Silence of the Lambs, Memento, and today I wrote a thing about Nolan's films up to this point to celebrate Matthew McConaughey's birthday slash Interstellar Eve. And yeah, next week we'll be talking about Interstellar because we are both Nolan fans, as you found out on the Memento podcast. Follow us on Twitter at the MacGuffin Men. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Give us 5-star ratings. Recruit other people to give us 5-star ratings. Just literally anybody that you meet. Anyway, we'll just get right to this podcast because we've been fucking around for long enough.
The name of my company is Video Production News, a professional news gathering service. That's how it should be read, and that's how it should be said. I also want to go to the next rung and meet your team and the station manager and the director and the anchors and start developing my own personal relationships. I'd like to start meeting them this morning. You'll take me around, you'll introduce me as the owner and president of Video Production News and remind them of some of my many other stories. I'm not done. I also want to stop our discussion over prices. This will save time. So when I say that a particular number is my lowest price, that's my lowest price. And you can be assured that I arrived at whatever that number is very carefully. Now, when I say that I want these things, I mean that I want them. And I don't want to have to ask again.
James. James.
Yes?
What are we talking
yep.
about?
Yep.
What are we attempting to talk about today?
Nightcrawler.
Okay. Correct. We're on the same page.
Yep. Nightcrawler, you saw this movie at TIFF, right?
I did see it at TIFF. That is correct.
Okay. So it came out, it was shown at TIFF and I guess actually had a wide or limited theatrical release. It's out everywhere now.
Yeah, it's out everywhere. I think TIFF was the world premiere. I think I was there for the world premiere. It was just sort of that was where they started their promotional kick for the movie was. We're going to TIFF. We're going to show it to Torontoites or whatever we call people from Toronto. And that's where it kicked off. Anyway, yeah.
Oh, fun story. did you have a high level of anticipation going into it?
I was very curious to see it, of course. I generally think Jake Gyllenhaal makes smart choices. Or at least he's one of those actors where you can always see the idea that led to him wanting to be in this movie, which I think isn't as common as one might think. But there's normally a good reason for him to be in a movie. Whether or not the execution is good is another thing. But I was certainly curious. And my relationship with the Gilroy family is pretty strong. I enjoy Tony Gilroy's work. So seeing his brother's first film was something that I'd be interested in. Yeah.
Yeah, this is Dan Gilroy's first time as a director, and he wrote this play as well.
Yes, correct.
Yeah, I think we both like Jake Gyllenhaal. We both really like Zodiac. Mm-hmm. We both actually saw the movie Enemy and enjoyed it, which not a lot of people even saw it, but it is a good little movie.
Yeah. Yeah, it is quite good.
And did this movie meet your lofty expectations?
I will say, I like parts of this movie a lot. I think it's in general a good movie, and I think there are parts that I kind of roll my eyes at. But for the most part, it's quite a good film, and it's certainly very entertaining to watch. You know, like it when I saw it at TIFF the first time. You know, when you see a movie at TIFF, it's a movie theater with like 1,000 people in it. You know, and there was so much raucous laughter when I saw this movie, and it's just kind of a weird off-kilter movie, and the parts that are good are very good, but there are some things that bring it down for me a little bit.
It's a very engaging movie. I thought it was gonna be good, but I couldn't have really high expectations just because I didn't know much about it. The trailers made it look interesting.
You do not have the strong relationship with the Gilroy family that I do.
No, but I'm always into a movie that at least looks like it's trying to be different and interesting.
Yeah, fair enough.
Which this movie definitely had going for it, and I like Jake Gyllenhaal, and it looked like it might be a media criticism interesting kind of small little movie, and so that's kind of a few things that are going to sell me on a movie.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, so let's go over the pros and cons. What worked for you? What didn't?
Or what didn't work for me was pretty much the media criticism. I felt okay. like that was the part that I was the least interested in. I feel like I had seen most of it before, and I think luckily there aren't a lot of parts of this movie that require just that part to be engaging. But I thought a lot of it was things I've already thought about as far as the media criticism, and it's just like, oh my God, if it bleeds, it leads, you know?
yeah.
That kind of stuff was a little Liz Lemon eye roll to me, but the stuff about entrepreneurship, I was a huge fan of.
Oh yeah, that's what you liked about it.
Oh, so much. I thought it was a really, really good look at ambition and new careers that have to exist, and careers that make no sense that you can make exist. And that was the stuff that I found really engaging. And when I sent you a text that night, I think after I saw Nightcrawler, like, if you're into seeing this movie, we should do a podcast on it. And that was the stuff that led me to it, you know.
So not necessarily like the business of media, but just business and
yeah, just business in general, like Jake Gyllenhaal talking like Tony Robbins, more or less, you know, like that was the stuff I found really fascinating.
Yeah, I think Lou Bloom, Jake Gyllenhaal's character, is a very engaging, interesting, fun to watch character.
Yeah, he's fun to watch for sure.
And not be around.
Yeah, exactly. If you see him, you're having the worst day of your life.
The fact that so much of his dialogue sounds like it's from, like, how to make it in business and, like, all these self-help books and kind of how to be an effective leader. It's something I really haven't seen a lot of, even though we've seen characters who are big and gung-ho and, you know, trying to make it in business. It's not completely new, but his character is what I think makes this movie for me. Like, I don't think I'm with you. I don't think the media criticism stuff is really done that well. I think it kind of touches on some things that Network did decades ago and doesn't really update very much, yeah, to be honest.
It's yeah, exactly. It's much less unique, so it makes it way less interesting. Yeah.
Right. But I think the centerpiece of this movie is that character and Jake Gyllenhaal's performance. And yes, I understand those things go hand in hand, but that's what it was for me mostly.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's great in it. And you are correct. This is one of those like one character shows. And you know, there's a lot of a There Will Be Blood vibe to it to me. I think this movie's strongly influenced by There Will Be Blood, and not just because they have the same cinematographer. But there is that sort of vibe of sort of just this one character that exists. Like, his mind is totally different from everybody else in the movie. And if the movie kind of rests on that character, you know, that character being engaging specifically.
Oh, 100%. It's very much, I mean, there's other characters in this. It's still a small cast. But yeah, similar to Daniel Plainview and There'll Be Blood, this is so much about one character and one actor. And again, playing somewhat similar characters, not to the point that it never felt redundant. Like, it never seemed like there's only really point in watching one of those two movies, because they're both very good movies.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, another character who just has that drive and makes his own way in the world and has very lofty goals and does anything to achieve them. And just very misanthropic characters. And there was the bit of dialogue that really reminded me of Daniel Plainview the most was when he said, "What if it's not that I don't understand people? It's just that I don't like them." And, you know, obviously that reminds me of Daniel Plainview saying to his supposed brother, "I don't know how long I can keep doing it, handling these people." And just like the word "people" coming out of his mouth, it feels so gross to him. Like, he doesn't even like the word. He's so disgusted with the concept of humanity in general, which are two parts of each of those movies that really stick with me. But that one really drove it home for me. And again, not in a negative way, but it just seemed like another way to explore a kind of a similar character, but done so in a very effective way.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, like I said, it's a surprisingly funny movie. Jake Gyllenhaal, I mean, I wasn't surprised that he's funny. I mean, he kind of plays that sort of, he's got good comic timing when he is supposed to be funny in general, like in other things when he's been on SNL. And his character in Robert Graysmith and Zodiac is often played up to comedic effect. So he kind of fits that nice little in-between space that you need to do to be able to seem crazy but also be like really engaging, you know? And obviously the writing is part of that in this film as well. And there are some very funny lines in this film, but I think they're made that much more funny by the performance.
Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. He's like, after you've seen the movie and you look back at all the things he's done, and we'll talk about kind of his progression of, I don't even know how to describe it, but, you know, his descent, I guess, but I don't even know if that's the right term.
I think it's an ascent, to be honest.
Yeah, kind of, well, business-wise, an ascent, for
yeah.
sure.
Yeah,
it's just incredible watching kind of how this goes. And he gets into some very insane situations and some, dangerous situations. Lots of crazy things happening around him. And he manages to keep his cool almost all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it is. It's watching someone do these completely amoral, sometimes violent, usually reprehensible acts and be really calm and control about it.
Yeah.
And there's very few lines of his dialogue in this movie that you could look at on paper and say, this person is a bad person. Like, he doesn't say that many things. He's just a very direct, effective communicator.
Yeah.
But it's such absurd circumstances that, you know, the top five tips on how to talk to your employees doesn't really seem like it should be like what's going on in your mind right now when you're dealing with these situations. And that just shows the complete disconnect that he has from everyone around him.
Yeah, exactly. I was reading an interview with Jake Gyllenhaal about this movie where he talks about pretty much everything that Lou says on paper he agrees with. You know, like every one of his quotes makes sense to him. It's just sort of this where these quotes exist and with what actions we see them paired with, you know, that it sort of really is where Lou sort of starts to take hold. You know?
I know, that's the thing. I was trying to just think of a description of this character and words to describe him. I think he's a sociopath.
Oh, but then think?
Which is bad. And then after that, I don't really have that many bad things to say about him.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I know sounds terrible for all the awful things he does, but he's very polite. He's like, he just, the way he functions seems like someone who could deal in society and function. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I guess he does. He as you said, he kind of ascends. He does very well for himself throughout this movie, financially speaking, I guess we'll say.
Mm-hmm.
But he's not like a rude, loose cannon kind of guy. He's very, as I said, very in control. Like one of the moments where he seems to be losing it the most is when Bill Paxton kind of won't leave him alone with his job offer.
Yeah, exactly. That's the only time he's ever like vocally suggests violence, you know, or any like fairly mild sort of violence, but still, you know.
Exactly. And one of the few times I can think of when he uses profanity, even. Mm-hmm. The quote is, I feel like grabbing you by the ears right now and screaming, I'm not fucking interested. Instead, I'm going home and doing some accounting.
Yeah.
Which is a hilarious line. It gets a huge laugh. Like, it's so funny. But, like, okay, so that's him talking. And at that scene, he's speaking kind of at the level I'm speaking right now. Like, he's really not aggressive about it. Not a violent stance. Not up in his face. Not a loud volume. Just explains it to him. And that's what he's holding back. He says, I want to hold you by the ears and scream, I'm not fucking interested.
Mm-hmm.
Which isn't really that bad, considering how he's being hounded over and over. Like, and that's what he's holding back. And even then, like, it's really not that bad, it seems. Like, he's very under control. he could take a swing at this guy, but instead he's just communicating very directly, and to the point where he will kind of suggest something violent, very delicately, as mm-hmm. saying, like, this is what I want to say to you, not even to threaten you. This is what I want to say. Like, it's just incredible the kind of the two levels that he's functioning on through this movie, with such a regard for being polite and being a good communicator and being efficient and all these things, and then his just complete disregard for human, you know, lives and emotion.
Yeah, I think a couple of the things that are important to know about what you just described is it's not like we don't see this rage inside Lou, because we do see him basically do that whole I'm going to the bathroom to look at myself in the mirror for a minute and then scream and punch the mirror, you know, and but that is when he's alone in his apartment. And I think there's that scene at the very beginning of the movie where he's trying to sell the scrap metal and the fence that he steals, where he's talking to the person he's trying to sell these things to, and they're trying to negotiate, and then he basically says, oh, I'd start work as an intern if you have a job for me. And the guy who wants to be his boss says, no, I don't hire thieves. Because at that point in the movie, that's exactly what Lou is. And we see that scene end wordlessly, but we see Lou sort of like standing, thinking for a second, and then kind of cluing in and smiles. And he makes like some weird finger point that is very Lou Bloomy. And then he just leaves. And I think that scene is meant to show us that he needs to be wary of how people perceive him. And I think he just doesn't clue into the fact that because this guy sees him as a thief, he won't hire him, so he can't get ahead. So he tries to be very careful, or as careful as possible, for people to always see him being polite. The problem is he doesn't totally understand what you can and can't say.
Can you think of an example of something that something he says that's off-putting? Because unless he's being really kind of direct and threatening and private, which he doesn't do a lot, I thought he was pretty good about being aware of how he's perceived and what kind of social rules he needs to play by.
I think it's basically just his perception of sex that is kind of, I mean, it even sort of, we even see Rene Russo's character not react well to it. And Rene Russo is kind of like his protector in the news station. Like, she's always the one that's like, oh yeah, we can run this, you know, it's corpses, it's fine. People will talk about it, you know. Might make them vomit up their breakfast, but at least they'll talk about it over the water cooler, you know? But I think it's when he discusses sex with her in such a frank manner, I think that is kind of the time where he says things that are definitely inappropriate, you know?
Yeah, but I think he knows they're inappropriate, and he's just bargaining. Like, he's a lot of the time with Nina, it seems like he's blackmailing her, but he doesn't really have anything on her. Like, he's just constantly leveraging whatever it is. And, you know, as you said, she's not at the best station. She's not at the best shift. The ratings aren't great.
She's at the worst of both, you know, like literally the worst station and the worst shift.
Right. So I don't perceive that as him not understanding what's appropriate. I mm-hmm. think it's more him knowing that that's, you know, it would be a faux pas if he wasn't so determined to get what he wants.
Like, yeah.
I think he knows that's not the way you would speak to someone in front of their family. But, you know, maybe
well,
he could do a
speaking
sec,
that way
would be
to
more
her,
relevant.
He is speaking to her family, or in front of her family, the director's her husband.
Right.
But, yeah, no, that's true.
Like that's one of the things that I find so captivating about this character is that, you know, as he says in that speech, he understands humans. He just doesn't care. Like, he knows she would be offended by that and feel kind of objectified and cheap, but he has a goal in making people feel bad. Like, that is something he actively tries to avoid, because hurting people's feelings can sometimes stop you from getting what you want. But mm-hmm. in this case, it's what it takes to get what he wants. And I think he's absolutely brilliant. I think he understands human interaction fantastically. He just doesn't have the same priorities and emotions that we do.
Yeah, that's fair. Another quote I got from Jake Gyllenhaal about about Lou is that he says he's so well prepared. He's like the Bobby Fischer of manipulators. And I thought that was kind of funny.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's what I mean when it seems like he's blackmailing. Like, it seems like he really has some secret about her, but he just knows where she is in life. And mm-hmm. he knows that he is valuable to her and he's going to exploit that.
Yep. Yeah, I think you are correct. The thing that I sort of found interesting as he the way he was portrayed is that in tying in with the general pleasant manner of how he goes about his day, like talking to people and stuff, and we get those shots of him alone in his apartment watering his plant and watching TV and laughing to himself even after he looks around, which is kind of weird, but certainly fits his character, I would say. But he was kind of portrayed like, he just sort of seems to me like this character that is I don't know, because normally when we see somebody ambitious like this, they're kind of nerdy in a way, you know. They're either like uber alpha male, like sort of a Gordon Gekko type, or they are kind of the nerd from high school that works really hard and, you know, wants to be in all of these extracurricular activities. And I feel like
Zuckerberg.
Yeah, that's a good one. But yeah, there's just sort of that middle space between super ambitious alpha male and super ambitious nerd, and I think that's the space that Lou exists within. And with that comes sort of some of the politeness that you have touched on. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. You brought up something. What's with the plant? It's something we see, I think, at least three times. Like, yeah, him actively watering it, too, not just in the background.
Yeah, I guess I didn't think a lot about the plant. I don't know. I thought about the blue walls in his apartment, as per our conversation about Memento last week. But yeah, I didn't think a lot about the plant. But I think it's just sort of... I suppose it's they want it to be seen as a visual metaphor for his business. He wants to keep things growing, you know.
Yeah, it never really gets notably bigger.
No, that's true. And I mean, I would say the watch falls into that same thing. And you know, like, because the watch that he steals in the first scene of the movie, steals from the security guard, we see him wearing it throughout the movie, and it's always too big for him. And even in the last scene, or I suppose the second last scene is the last time we really see it, where he's walking out of the police station, we get a close-up of his wrist to show that he still, it still doesn't fit him, but he's still wearing it. And I think the purpose of the watch is meant to be this thing to aspire to. Like, he wants to be able to fill out this, I don't know a lot about watches, but it looked like a nice watch. I don't know.
I also don't know anything about watches, but it appears to be a nice watch.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I wear an elastic band around my wrist, so like, what do I know? But it sort of felt like it was something he wanted to grow into. Like, his business, he would stop trying so hard to grow his business when that watch finally fit him. And we don't see that happen in this movie, which is why the movie ends with him expanding his business, you know?
Right. And one thing about the watch, which I thought was nice, it was just at the beginning, he kind of gets in that fight with the security guy you're talking about that he mm-hmm. steals the watch from. And in kind of the way that this movie, I think, does a good job of looking realistic. I don't think that there's a person like Lou Bloom who's lived that life, but I think they do. I think it's a pretty realistic approach to making a movie. Like, it all looks normal.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
It's not super stylized, and a lot of crazy stuff that goes down. But in keeping with that, I love that first fight. Like, it's an ugly fight, like, where you just kind of hug and then try to overpower and fall to the ground. Like,
yeah, it's more of a takedown than anything, you know? And it's just shown in a wide shot from far away, you know?
Yeah, and there's just nothing dramatic or nothing spectacular about it all. It's just kind of the grimy stuff he's willing to do. And, you know, at that point in his life, at that point in the movie, he is just cutting chain link fence and putting it in the back of his shitty little car and then trying to sell it to people. And then, you know, that he'll try to parlay into an internship and then a job and all these kinds of things. Like, you kind of see him just chipping away at things. And yeah, again, with the watch, it's just kind of, yeah, this nice thing. And it's really not his station in life yet. And that's why it looks awkward on him and it's falling all over and it's too shiny for his, like, everything else in his life pretty much at that point.
Yeah, it looks, and it's weird. Like, I know you're going to laugh when I say this, but I mean, I generally, you know, losing weight for a role or whatever doesn't, isn't the quickest way to my heart as an actor. But I think with this role specifically, it was a nice touch. I think Gyllenhaal said he wanted to look emaciated. He wanted to look hungry. But the thing that I think really drives it home is just something that, I mean, he couldn't really have done. He just has these naturally broad shoulders. Like in this movie, he looks like he still has the shoulders of like this really buff guy. He just doesn't have the muscle or like the weight anymore. Right. And it looks like he has shoulders that are too big for his body. And I think that's sort of this weird tiny thing that they couldn't have worked on at all. That's just sort of the luck of casting. But it's like he needs to still grow into his body, which I think is another nice little touch that really ties into the watch, you know?
Yeah. So what do you make of his upgrade on his car? Doesn't he have he has a very nice car. Again, we're people who don't care about watches and cars, so yeah. We're not going to explain exactly what each of them are.
Yeah.
But his car seems too nice for Lou, no matter how much money he's making, right?
Yeah, but then there's also, I mean, a car is a status symbol, as is jewelry, right? And he certainly wants to be seen as somebody that is successful, you know? That matters to him a lot, and that's his whole, when he declares, you must identify my footage as being a video news production or video production news, a news production company or whatever,
yeah.
Whatever bland thing he makes people say. I think he cares about being seen a certain way. He wants to stick out from the crowd. And I do think, and I know there are probably less flashy ways to have a car that's better for his job, but I think from a utilitarian perspective, he certainly needed an upgrade in his car, right?
Yeah, and it certainly appears to be like a fast car, obviously. Yeah. So in his line of work, it is relevant. I just thought
it photographs really well, you know?
Yeah. No, I agree, because that was kind of the first place my mind went to, similar to the watch. It's, you know, it's this flashy thing. He wants to move up in the world. He wants to be, you know, seen to be not ground floor anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's very statusy, and not just in the way that a lot of people have nice cars, but he never shows it off. He never talks about his car. He doesn't seem to have any personal pleasure in how nice it looks or how expensive it was.
He gets upset at Rick when he gets gas on it, though.
That's true.
Yeah, but I mean that's very small, but it's
yeah, that's true. It did seem more work performance than my, you know,
yep.
My whip, you know, but I mean it to say, like, it's also joyless to him. Like, he has this really, really nice car that I think a lot of people would be happy to have, but we never really see him like it or talk about how much it was, or you know, just all those little 1 or 2 second shots that are in movies where people are in love with their car, whether mm-hmm. you know, just like shining up the light or, you know, dusting off anything. That just doesn't happen in this movie. And it's like, I just see him reading one of those books he talks about and coming across, like, you know, that something like dress for the job you want, not the job you have. Like, I think he looks at that car and doesn't see anything and gets no joy from it, but
yeah.
Understands that to progress, you need to put off this image. And you know what I mean? Like, I don't think it makes him happy. I don't think he is excited about the women who are going to approach him for it. I know what people think of him other than how this pushes him forward in his particular goal of being like a freelance videographer, news videographer.
Yeah, absolutely. And I agree with you. And I think, like I said, there is a utility to it as well. I'm sure that car from the same, you know, if him and Bill Paxton are in Bill Paxton's van are starting off right next to each other, I think, and trying to get to the same spot faster than the other, I think Jake Gyllenhaal wins every time, right?
Oh yeah, 100%.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I do agree. I don't think he gets any joy out of it, you know. But I think I think the only thing that really matters to him is a progression of his business, and that's why the only times we really see him being happy are, or you know, a mild sense of happiness are when he's progressing his business. And there are exceptions to this, like I mentioned, when he's watching TV alone at his apartment and ironing a shirt. But for the most part, the moments that we're supposed to really key in on as him being kind of happier than normal are all related to his business more than anything material.
Well, and I don't think even just related to his business, but related to like networking, you know, like it's not that he's like, oh, this is where I was and now it's here's where I am. I'm going to smile and laugh a bit because I have personal joy.
Yeah.
I don't know his ability to actually experience tons of personal joy. You know, you see him happy to talk to Kent Shocknick and whatever the woman's name was. Like, that's when you really see him happy and stuff. But it's, you know, it's just like, oh, I could tell by your tie it's Friday. Mm-hmm. Like, that's something he's seen normal people do. And that's how humans communicate with each other. And that's how, you know, you make friends with the people higher up than you. And then you're up there with them. Like, he really seems just like a great actor. Like, he just seems so, you know, I mean, Lou, not Gyllenhaal. Like, yeah. he's just disengaged from human emotion until there's a situation that he recognizes as a stepping stone to something bigger. And then he's just so good at being jovial and making friends and being so happy-go-lucky and fun to be around. And, you know, then we, because that's what's going to get him into his next step. And then we see him talking with Nina, Rene Russo, and he's doing the same thing. He's getting to that next step, whatever it takes. But now it's just, you know, since they're in private and it's about something sexual, it's just cold and short and it's just so different. But it's, I don't think they're that much different to him. I think he just sees them both as however I need to act to get to the next level.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there are two really important scenes in this movie. Two speeches, maybe three, I suppose. But the third one is just much less interesting to me. But there's that moment. I don't think it's the first time he sells tape to Nina. It might be the second or third, where they're just sort of walking into the news studio together, the production studio. And they're discussing how Lou is basically, he thinks he's found something that he loves and something he's good at, and he's talking about TV news.
Yeah.
And it's shot in a couple long takes, and there's actually a really good clip of Dan Gilroy talking about it on the New York Times, doing sort of one of their Anatomy of a Scene videos that are always very good, basically giving commentary. And what he says is, he says he wanted Jake Gyllenhaal to perform it like he was asking Rene Russo to marry him. And that's sort of the most honest emotion we see from, like, honest human emotion we see from Lou, because he does seem legitimately emotional in that scene. And it ends with that nice little moment of him saying, oh, it all looks so real on camera. And then we cut to him seeing the LA backdrop, right? And it's him talking about how he is kind of this wayward type of person. Like, he was just, he was literally robbing and stealing, you know, he was a thief before this. And
I think is just days before this too. Like,
yeah,
this
exactly.
Isn't distant past. Like, this I think maybe the day of or the day before.
Exactly. Like, he sees Bill Paxton for the first time the day or like right after he leaves from selling that scrap metal, you know, the night he steals the watch. And yeah, it's just sort of, he's found his purpose and it's this, and he gets kind of emotional about it. And I think that's something that I find really interesting and really human for Lou, because that's something that I think is just extremely human. It's feeling like you don't have a purpose and then feeling like you do have a purpose, and how you know how to spend this very long period of time that you have to worry about filling, you know, which is your life, you know, like your career. And I find that scene very interesting.
Yeah. And for all the times I know I've said, you know, he's not sincere about any of this. He's just saying what needs to be said. I think at that point he is sincere. Like, I think that's kind of a speech a lot of people make in their life to potential bosses that, they're lying to them. They're either lying to their boss or themselves about.
Yeah.
But this does seem genuine, and it's different than the way he talks to the foreman after looking for like a construction job, even though he still sells that one pretty well. And it's, you know, he's giving it 100% and he's using all those lines and all those words that has been proven will get you jobs and get you positive attention and things like that. But in the studio, you're right. Like, it's next level. Like, it's it's sincere. He really does. I really believe he does believe what he's saying at that point.
And yeah, this goes back to the Dan Gilroy video I mentioned. He says that at the end of that scene where after Nina leaves the studio and Lou is by himself, we see him sort of get up onto the stage and sit at the anchor's desk. And we cut to this wide shot and we see him leaving the backdrop of LA for this TV news desk. And we're now seeing him in a monitor. And Dan Gilroy explained that as Lou basically walking out of normal human world and into the world of TV news. And I sort of, that definitely makes sense. But I also sort of see that as him leaving this sort of aimless city for this one destination, you know, this one physical destination, you know, this place he wants to be.
Which is still within the city and all about the city, but
allows... But it's a much more pointed place.
Oh, yeah, that's what I mean. And it's even if he's not in that studio, when he's on the road and he's just, you know, driving around L.A., it's still for a purpose. And it's all tied back to that place. Like, he's not just wandering around looking for scrap metal or looking for a now hiring sign or something. Like, he's very goal-oriented at this point.
Exactly. And to tie into that, the second instance of a scene like that that I wanted to bring up is later after, I think this is after he finds the home invasion tape, or maybe it's it's after the home invasion tape, when he's talking to Nina. And we get a shot, and they're in an edit bay. They're not in the new studio. But we get a shot of from behind Nina, framed up on Lou, as Lou gives a monologue about his business and slowly walks towards Nina. And it's framed in a very similar way. And the purpose of the scene is to show this is when he demands for his footage to be mentioned on air, like his company's name, all that stuff. And it's this real, like... And of course, the house arrest footage is a big deal to that station. There's a lot of focus put into it on the movie as well. It's a real, like, moving on up sort of moment. And that's why I think it's framed in that perspective and why it happens in a much darker room, because it's a much more cold sort of emotion. Like, we're in this dark edit bay when he's doing this, as opposed to the brightly lit studio where he finds his purpose. Now we find out his purpose might be leading him down this dark path. And I thought they were really nice companion speeches, you know?
Yeah. And I was thinking, you know, when he does find himself kind of comfortable, as we said, or kind of finds himself in that studio and sees something he wants and sees, or something he, you know, who he really is, some goals he feels comfortable working towards. Is it because the kind of, their job, or at least the I think one of the points this movie tries to make, is that they deal just in deception and fear mongering and very cutthroat techniques. And, you know, it's this, you know, bright, colorful, symmetrical, nice looking place. But it's really, again, as I believe this movie is trying to put forward, very dishonest, very selfish kind of existence and kind of job and kind of environment. And, you know, we get that, you know, bright studio and all the colors and all the good looking people in makeup and nice clothing. And then we get the kind of dark editing bay, kind of the seedy underbelly that allows the studio to function. And, you know, true to reality, the studio is much brighter than the editing bay, you know, as it would be, but it goes from so bright to so dark.
And yeah, exactly.
It seems more than just the utilitarian lighting. We get this really nice place that, you know, everyone's smiling, speaking in full sentences, and then we get to this kind of dark editing bay, and everyone's being short and snappy with each other, and, you know, no one's smiling, no one's making eye contact. It's all just jargon, like, we'll cut this, we'll do this, put that in with the sweep, and then we're good. Like, it's all... very kind of very cold, very jargon, very self-contained. Like, there's this little place that only a few people, you know, we only see three or four people ever in that editing bay. And as I said, it's kind of dark and everyone's speaking very business-like. And then we get the studio and everyone's speaking, you know, so politely and, you know, welcoming everyone to the show and all this kind of stuff. Yeah. And then, you know, obviously it gets dark in there too, as they're talking about a lot of the very grisly footage that he's captured. But it's just the juxtaposition between those two places. And, you know, we see Lou kind of fall in love with the bright lights and everything, but really gets comfortable and really has no problem in kind of the dark underbelly, as I said.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree entirely. One thing while we're talking about the dark underbelly, we had briefly discussed about, you asked me basically if there were any visual things about this movie that bothered me. I think you meant specifically that there are some shots that are grainy in this film. You sent me a link to a message board about people being frustrated about this.
Yeah, I did not understand the term video noise.
So. Okay, yeah, it's just sort of like it's grainier footage. And from what I can tell, they shot the exteriors digitally. Because it's better for working in low light, and the interiors in the news station seem to be shot on film, where it's harder to shoot in a dark room on film, which is where you get this noise, specifically in the edit bays. I thought the idea of shooting the exteriors digitally, like where Lou is in his world and going into the studio and shooting film, is kind of like this very old world mentality in there. Like it's this old medium that they're trying to spice up by taking things out of Lou's world where Lou is shooting digital, you know? And this new format and this new style of news, you know, basically like getting the bloody ambulances or doing ambulance chasing and stuff and then putting it in this old world and trying to change it up a bit. I thought that was interesting, an interesting contrast, an interesting idea to sort of use the old style of filmmaking in the new studio and use a newer style when you're out on the streets of LA. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
Particularly for a movie that I think has the budget of $8 million to shoot. Anything on film is impressive, you know?
Yeah, it does have an $8 million budget and does not have an $8 million appearance in my opinion.
No, I found that out 20 minutes before we started this podcast and was floored. I could not believe it. It yeah. looks like at least $30 million, you know?
Oh, and, yeah. Like, I think it's great.
Yeah, it's Robert Elswit's shooting it. He's a pro. But yeah, they get quite a bit out of very little, it seems.
Okay, so speaking of new media, I kind of went into this movie really knowing he was shooting ambulances and selling it to a news station. Didn't know much else. Mm-hmm. And I had a couple expectations in my head. And kind of looking at this now, in reading a lot of reviews about it, I heard some people say it's like Network for the 21st century.
Okay.
Also, we did a podcast on Network if you want to listen to that.
Yeah, but shout outs to Patty Chayefsky.
What I was expecting and what I think a lot of people were expecting and what I think doesn't make this Network for the 21st century is the lack of new media and kind of name checking TMZ and the internet doesn't even come up at all. Like, we know this is set currently. He talks like there's a mention of the internet. But I just thought this was going to be a media movie. And I thought any news media, any media movie at all kind of has to address things like social media and has to address the internet. And it's about a guy running around the city filming people against their will. How is TMZ not kind of represented in some way?
Yeah, I think, I mean, Twitter is mentioned, an offhanded comment.
Yeah, it's there.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And Lou basically says he, whenever somebody questions him about how he knows so much about a certain topic, but be it Nina's background or running a business, he says, well, I mean, I'm a child of the internet. You can look anything up. Yeah, you're correct that they don't touch on it a lot, but that's why the part of the movie about ambition or the side of the movie that's about ambition is way better than the side of the movie that's about media, just because you're correct. It's not, I don't think it's meant to be the primary focus of the movie. And it definitely isn't, you know, as far as like how I perceive it. And I think it's just more interesting that it's about ambition within this world. And we only get shades of the world that this is happening within, but we get tons of sort of examples of this very ambitious guy and what he says and what he's willing to do. I think that's what's more interesting about the movie. And you are correct. It doesn't touch on media enough to be a really strong comment on media, which is exactly why we both think that's the weaker part of the movie.
Yeah. And I I've looked over and I've seen, because this is getting good reviews and people are kind of lining it up with a lot of other well-respected movies. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I saw Network for the 21st Century and I saw Taxi Driver for the 21st Century. I think Taxi Driver is more appropriate.
Yes. I think There Will Be Blood is as appropriate as it gets as far as I'm concerned.
That's true. It's so recent, though, that it's...
Yeah, well, I mean, people just, I don't know, people just like comparing things to other things, and we need touchstones that we all recognize, and very frequently the touchstones we all recognize are because they were extremely famous or very good films, such as Taxi Driver and Network, and that means that we're basically leading into hyperbole, you know? Like, it's just kind of the only way to make the comparison is, like, you can't... Oh, in September of 1998, there was this wonderful little film that came out. It made $4 million, you know, called Get Carter. It reminds me of that.
Yeah, you kind of need things people know about.
Yeah, exactly. No, no, not the Michael Caine version, the Sylvester Stallone one.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And that is the side of the movie that succeeds is definitely more the kind of ambitious misanthrope. Navigates through a human world versus you know, there's some executives who are fucking with your TV. And I mean, we get parts of that, and I think they do parts of that well.
Yeah. I mean, there are
a couple little things they hit on you know, successfully, and maybe he knew that there wasn't a whole movie there and kind of nitpicks a couple things, does them well, and moves on to a character piece, which is where this movie finds its feet.
Yeah, the thing is, I think there is definitely a movie there. I think this is what we get out of it is just more unique, you know? He could definitely do, anybody could do a movie about night crawling with a much more specific focus on the news aspect of it, as opposed to, what it means to news and all that, as opposed to focusing on the ambition. I just think it's more interesting and unique the way they went with it. And I think that makes Nightcrawler a more fascinating movie than the one that could have happened out of it, you know?
Yeah, and it's just it's interesting because we kind of have people who are like Lou, who make Lou look so much worse because Lou is further on the spectrum than they are. I mean, yeah. Nina doesn't seem to be a stand-up human being. She doesn't do anything nearly as bad as Lou. But I think that's part of her function is to show how much worse someone can be than her. And that's Lou Bloom.
Yeah. Her, I mentioned it very briefly. Her place in the movie is to be sort of the protector of that style of thing that Lou is doing. Like by her buying this footage and being willing to put it on air, she's making news worse. And, again, we focus so much less on her, that it again makes the news stuff less interesting because we're seeing more of the ambition than the media, which is more, Lou cares more about his ambition than he does about media itself. You know, it's just sort of the thing he's good at and loves.
Yeah. Yeah. But there are moments like her, you know, being so willing to show things like very violent things. She doesn't seem to suggest pixelating the faces to hide their identity till someone else mentions it, which I think is pretty cold. And then when the story comes out that this wasn't, you know, as she always wants, urban crime sneaking into the white suburbs. You know, the triple homicide had drugs hidden in the place. It's, you know, just upper class crime getting involved with lower class crime and getting the end of the shotgun for it. So we do see her engage in these pretty shady things. It's even just the way she said, this is what people want. Think about news as a woman running down the street with her throat slit. Like, all these very grotesque, unpleasant things. And no mention of journalistic integrity or anything like that. Obviously, like, that's just so far at the door, it doesn't even bear mentioning.
Yeah.
So why is she, like, she kind of just disappears from the story, no? Like, she doesn't have an ending to her arc, really. Is that just because this is just a Lou movie?
Yes, it is a Lou movie. I think the ending of her arc is, and you kind of quoted it, where that scene where I don't even know what that guy's job is, but informs her that it wasn't a home invasion. There were drugs and all that, and that she was willing to just leave that by the wayside. The end of that scene is her quoting Lou. And I think that's kind of that's the end for her character, is that Lou's ambition has affected her to the point where she kind of starts to see his logic. And the idea is that it's kind of a sort of race to the bottom type of thing. And Lou is leading the charge, and he's bringing Nina along with her now. You know, she has given in to Lou's ideals.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's, here's this person who is kind of, yeah, race to the bottom, like is kind of willing to do whatever it takes. And then there's someone who redefines what it takes. And maybe now what it takes is setting up murders for you to film, like, and she, we don't see her do that, but we see her on board with someone who is more than willing to do that. And yeah, I think, you know, we don't have to watch her do these things. She kind of gives it her blessing at that point, and that's kind of as bad as it needs to be.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. What about the comparisons to Drive?
I mean, it's got Drive on the posters, you know, like, because it's got that whole From the Producers of Drive thing, which generally means nothing. It just means that this is something that this person has also worked on, you know?
And
we don't put their producers' faces on posters, so we never recognize their names either.
It's also large. Like, Drive would also be a very central character-focused movie, violent. L.A. Okay.
Yeah, here's the difference between Nightcrawler
and almost 80s.
I don't see a lot of 80s in Nightcrawler.
Okay.
I think the difference between Nightcrawler and Drive is that Drive just wants to be pretty and not really about anything. Nightcrawler desperately wants to be about something, and it's a much, much more interesting movie for it. They're both very well made movies that are absolutely entertaining. Nightcrawler's totally different, though. They just both have flashy cars and have LA and pretty people with nice eyes as their lead, you know?
Okay. Yeah. Did you expect Lou to fail? Was this going to be kind of a fly too close to the sun story?
I don't think I did. I don't know. I generally don't sort of try to predict things as I'm watching them anymore or before I watch them. Just because I prefer to sort of let the movie lead me as opposed to let my expectations lead my opinion on the movie, you know?
Yeah.
So I didn't spend a lot of time thinking about it, but I think we're at a point in movies where, these types of characters making it to the end generally unscathed is not surprising, you know? It's just it didn't catch me off guard that he makes it out of the movie basically the winner. Whereas maybe 20 years ago that would have been very surprising.
Do you want to explore what that means, or are you okay to point out that we're here where that's just normal now? Or that's not unexpected, at least?
I think we've talked about it enough that to quote Low Winter Sun promos that we never actually watched the show for, there's a lot of difference between black and white, and society's okay with that now, okay with that in their media, and that's something that's really been shown over the past 15 to 20 years. And
I don't think this is about him being gray, though. This is about him being black and successful.
I think it's about something that is generally seen as something positive, like having ambition, wanting to succeed, ending in sort of this black hole sort of thing.
Okay, right, yeah. Right, he does
I think mixing this white light of ambition with this darkness of you know, all the horrible things he does, we get gray in the middle, you know.
we still get the gray.
Yeah, how's that for some color wheel shit?
Some gritty gray finish. Yeah.
I don't know, that's kind of my take. Like, did you expect him to go out in a blaze of glory like Scarface and we all learn about
things? I don't try to predict too often either. I guess I expected to see the cops one more time.
Yeah, I love his last scene with the cops so much.
Oh, it's great. And it's kind of like, you know, Chekhov's police department, I guess. Like, once you kind of see cops, you know, in the first few acts, you expect them to, like, I don't know. I guess I was expecting them to kind of make one more big push and he outwits them, or one more big push and they close down on him and they did some digital forensics on the tape and whatever. They figure out that...
they zoomed and enhanced.
Yeah, exactly. 90 degrees. somehow. Like, I guess I was expecting them to see them one more time. You know, we see them twice. Usually things come in threes. Usually a cop will show up in the third act, maybe even just to put a button on it. Mm-hmm. We don't see them again. And yeah, that last scene with them is good. And I liked it at the time. And then in preparing for this, I kind of looked back and was like, oh yeah, that was his last scene with them. That's awesome. He just shuts them out and then that's it. Like, they're effectively out of his life.
As he leaves the police station, there's a minute and a half left in the movie before the credits. You know, like, it's just, it's so quickly that the movie ends after that. One thing that I really enjoyed, I have no idea if this was intended, but it's so close that it feels weird for it not to be intended.
Suspects?
Yeah. Have people been talking about this?
I saw one mention, but I thought of it at the time.
Okay. Because, like, it's just shot so similarly. And it was very odd. And
you don't like that?
Well, I very much enjoy the film, The Usual Suspects. I think that's a very good ending to a film. It just felt weird that it was mirroring that film so closely. And it felt like... and I understand, like, he's defeated the cops in that scene, which is basically what Verbal Kint's ending is as well. But yeah, I don't know. It really surprised me. I don't know. I guess maybe we're just at the point where movies I watched a lot as a child are now old enough that they can be directly referenced. You know? And it's not weird.
I think that's the case. I think it's silly to put kind of like a shout out to something out so late in your movie.
Yes.
That's what I found striking about that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I like the shot. Everything about that was good, other than maybe the placement to kind of put something else right in your mind just as you're kind of sealing up your movie. I thought was a little...
Yeah, it was exactly. It's like dropping the name Robin in the last minute of The Dark Knight Rises. It's like, it's just, let's calm down there for a sec, you know?
At least that's the same world.
Yeah. Well, I mean, for half a second, I was expecting Pete Postlewaite to drive around the corner, and I was like, nope, he's dead. He can't do it. Jake is by himself, you know? And I don't know. It's just really surprising. But
Pete Postlewaite comes around the corner on the bike. He won the Tour of Mexico.
No bike has 37 gears, James.
That was a great scene. I wanted more of that.
It was a really good scene. And the fact that the camera was stationary the whole time and we're just following Lou around was really nice. It was really funny. Yeah.
Yeah. You want to talk about the music?
No, it was terrible. Like, there were so many really bad moments of music in this film.
Okay, because we briefly discussed this movie after seeing it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I pointed out that I thought there were some very bad musical choices made throughout the film. And so I've since seen some people on both sides of this debate. And a lot of them who defend...
The right side and the wrong side?
A lot of the people who defend the music in this movie take the same angle on it. So what... How would you describe the music in this movie, not using qualitative words?
Inconsistent. Is that a qualitative word?
In this context, I'm afraid it is. Like, at any era or genre or...
No, that's what really bothered me. And because, I mean, I think there are moments in this movie that I think the director was like, hey, give me an explosions in the sky thing. And then there's another moment where I'm certain the director said, hey, give me that Trent Reznor, Atticus Ross shit, you know? Right. Because there's just so many drastic... And at the very end, as Rick is dying, it seems like he's doing his take on Brian Eno's Ascent, you know? And those are just three very different things. And they're all in this movie, and there just seems to be no real cohesion. It feels more like a mixtape than a score, you know?
Okay, yeah. Because that's how I felt too. And then I've only seen this movie once, but a lot of people are saying that there's kind of like a positive, like inspirational kind of feel to a lot of the music when it feels out of place.
Mm-hmm.
And they're kind of saying that's, you know, that's kind of we're kind of listening with Lou's ears. Like, he thinks what he's doing is ambitious and good and triumphant. But watching it as someone who's not Lou, you see that it's actually just, you know, disturbing and violent and reprehensible.
Yeah, I buy that explanation entirely. I think it does more, at least for me, and I think for you, it does more harm than good, just because it sticks out as being bad and inconsistent. And with that defense, the Trent Reznor moment doesn't make a ton of sense.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like, I love that explanation. I just don't think it applies here. Like, I think, as you said, the music is just so all over the place that you would need a consistent, you know, like, I think Drive kind of picked a tone of music and stuck with it for the most part.
Yeah.
That's what this movie didn't do. And
movies with good scores tend to do that.
Okay. But yeah, they were kind of saying, like, this is basically him playing like a kind of like a Gecko, like a Gordon Gecko, like someone you'd expect in an 80s movie who's like fighting the way to the top. Like, you could see Tom Cruise kind of doing it. Like, the guy, this character speaks in like kind of cheesy motivational quotes and like team building jargon and shit you'd hear at like a corporate retreat. And, you know, it's all kind of cheesy and like over the top. And that's why you get music that sounds like it's like a high school football movie.
Yeah. Also, is that Shots Fired at My Beloved Explosions in the Sky?
Okay, high school football. I didn't even mean that. That's awesome.
You leave Coach Taylor out of this, my friend.
I'll try my best.
I certainly can see that point, and at least for some points, but that would explain the horrible music at the end, because it's very triumphant, triumphantly terrible. But I don't think it does enough good stuff, you know?
No, I think that last song kind of stuck with people, and they kind of formulated a defense for poor musical choices around the one thing.
There's some bad direction in this movie. As much good direction as there is, there's some really bad stuff. And like, one of the things I really enjoyed about the direction of the movie, there's a lot of things framed in two shots, both wide and closer, with specifically Nina and Lou facing each other and having a conversation. There's a lot of this with Rick and Lou as well. And just sort of meant to be showing these differing ideals. You know, they're just sort of different, totally different people, because one is Lou and one is not Lou, you know?
Which is about as different as it gets.
Yeah, and it was just sort of this nice visual thing to come back to a lot of times. Even though it was very simple, the fact that they did it enough, it really kind of, I don't know, it was a nice moment. Or, sorry, a nice idea. And then there's stuff like the last shot of the movie, which I thought was interesting and tied into that, because we get...
Remind me what it is again?
We get Lou... The last part of the movie is sort of the third monologue, where we see Lou's further upgrade in his business, where he now has multiple crews. He's where Bill Paxton was before Bill Paxton presumably died. And he's giving a speech to his three new employees saying, you know, you are now hired, you have a job, let's go do this together. I forget what his last line is, but it's a very Lou last line, unsurprisingly. And then we get them going into these two vans and driving off in different directions. And the idea of that is that we still have these two perspectives, but Lou controls them both now, you know? And I thought that was really interesting and really nice, but it's just... There's a zoom on it for no reason that drove me crazy. And then we get that fade into a close up of the moon. And I just hated it. So it's like, I liked it so much and then hated it so much. And it was just really bizarre. And there was a movie that otherwise is generally really good, there are a few moments in this movie that I think are just really, really first time directory and lack a certain confidence, you know?
Right. And this is Dan Gilroy's first time. See, that kind of stuff doesn't bug me as much, and it makes me happy sometimes.
That it doesn't bother you?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we all have our things that bother us in film. Like, there are often narrative things that you have problems with that I have zero issue with, you know?
Yeah, and those didn't really present themselves as often in this one.
Yeah, exactly.
Would you say it's accurate that this movie doesn't do anything new but does a lot of old things well?
I think tying I think a lot of the, maybe this is just, I mean, I am a freelancer. That's my trade, you know, like not doing what Lou does, but I am a freelance video person, you know.
Let's repeat, he does not do what Lou does.
Yeah, exactly. I make videos freelance as a freelancer, but not of dying people. I thought that stuff, maybe just because it was so pointed directly at that, a type of job that I recognize, really was really fascinating to me. Cause I think that's sort of where it really hit me, was that he's doing a pretty new job and it's a very sort of modern type of entrepreneurship that he's engaging in. And, I thought that was really interesting. And it's this type of entrepreneurship that's a new job that you can help keep yourself going with. But it's also probably making the world a worse place. But we're just kind of at this point where these are the jobs that exist. And this is kind of how you have to what you have to do to make a living. And I thought that was what was new about it, was that it was a movie about ambition, but it was also a movie about entrepreneurship in a very modern context. Which I couldn't think of a movie that did that as well, you know?
Yeah, so it's, I mean...
That's the new thing to me.
Yeah, it's not so much network for the 21st century, but it is timely. Like, it is still dealing with something, you know, as you said, very new jobs, very new technologies. It's about ambition in this age.
Exactly.
Which is new enough.
Yeah, and I thoroughly enjoyed most of it and thought it's very entertaining all throughout.
Is it going to hold up? It's getting good reviews. I know that's kind of hard to say, but what can you see what might not age well, and what do you see kind of being something that could make this hold up as kind of a masterpiece long term?
Oh, I mean, masterpiece is a very strong word.
Okay, well, yeah.
Yeah. I think, I don't know, I sort of trust, or I sort of see movies, because yeah, you're correct, this movie is very much about a certain time period, and there'll be parts of it that very quickly age out of relevance, basically. But more so than I think most people, I tend to look at movies as a product of the time that they were made in, and... if certain things about this don't stay, you know, pertinent to American life over the next 10 years, I don't think it'll lessen the goodness of this film. It'll just sort of make it more time dependent than most films, you know?
Yeah. And I think if they did kind of those things that I was talking about expecting, like if it really did a lot of, whoa, isn't Twitter crazy? And is he Harvey Levin an asshole? Like 10 years, this isn't good. Like,
yeah.
If we deal with the timeless things like ambition and drive and self-deception and misanthropic males putting everyone in their way, like I think that's how things do hold up. And I think all the great movies, even if they're about something very temporary, it's because they did the universal timeless themes well that it holds up as something memorable.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you mentioned Mark Zuckerberg earlier. The Social Network will always be good even when it's no longer current, you know, just because it's about friendship and ambition.
And, yeah, and it's Facebook won't exist at a point, and this movie will probably still be an enjoyable watch about what it takes to get to the top and what people are willing to do to the top, more importantly.
Exactly. I mean, network television at some point won't exist, and network will still be good.
That's right.
Yeah. So thank you for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check back next week where we'll be talking about Interstellar. And James just remembered that Interstellar is coming out very soon. But yeah, be sure to check out our website, themacguffinmen.com. And again, tell everybody you've ever met in your life. Literally everybody, including us, if you've met us.
Your grandparents can figure out podcasting. It's not that
bad. So yeah, check us out on iTunes, Twitter, and themacguffinmen.com. Okay, thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.